based on, you know, holding power the way the colonial overlords used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at right now, the international response in the tragedy of Sudan, I mean, a lot of talk and a lot of pushing the Organization of African Unity to, you know, you Africans go get something done on this, which I think the Africans have the capability of doing a lot of it. I mean, the Nigerians, a huge, huge military force and other ones. But
with financial backing from the outside.
Mm-hmm. But it's I think it is important that Africans see that other countries out of Africa are interested in what goes on there and not just in ripping off the place for its natural resources.
So taking human rights seriously and keeping on doing it over and over again, mm-hmm. until people get the message that the United States cares, really.
Yes.
Does care.
Yeah, and the proof is in the pudding. They can see that we don't. We don't.
Yeah, just in the mm-hmm. practical way.
Yeah. We do care about oil, and we'll go invade a country that hadn't done anything to us and get that from them. And if they have oil, like Nigeria, well, indeed, if you look at Nigeria, southern Nigeria, it's an occupied state, occupied by international oil concerns and their huge security apparatuses. There are parts of Nigeria that Nigerians can't go into because that's the oil part.
And the murder of Ken Saro-Wiwa is only one example of that.
Yes.
The oil companies dominate the politics and everything there,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
mm-hmm.
and foster intertribal warfare that wouldn't otherwise be happening.
Yes,
but that's in your case in Sierra Leone. I understand you helped with the evacuation of people. You
yes.
organized that
mm-hmm.
in some way.
I was the acting ambassador at the time, and so when the determination was made in Washington that indeed we were going to close down the embassy. Well, first, the evacuation of all Americans and non-essential U.S. embassy personnel was the first thing that we were looking at. And there were a large number of Americans that were in Sierra Leone. And so organizing to get them out, and then as the security environment continued to deteriorate, that more and more people were saying, we think we probably need to get out, and other embassies and other international organizations like the UN and others were saying there's no way that we can protect our employees here because the security forces had turned over to the side of the rebels, and the rebels were being very brutal about coming into the big city. You know, the big city lights and all the things that were there, well, they were taking them all, and if you had a house that had something in it and they wanted it, they just came right in and off it went. I mean, it was amazing to be sitting in our compound and watching compounds next door, and all of a sudden you'd see a sofa walking across the wall. You know, out that goes, out that goes. And in fact, we had rebels come into our compound, and we talked them out of ripping off the compound, saying, you know, this is the U.S. Embassy. We, you know, the power of the United States, and you guys are going to be in big trouble.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't have anything to back it up right then.
But the name of the United States is a very fearful thing for some people.
Well, yeah. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it then becomes the target. But we were lucky there that we were able to convince them that those individual young guys that were, you know, just looting, out looting, that we would remember them and
we'll track
you boys
down.
That's right. You boys will be in big trouble. We did go ahead and let them use one of our vehicles because that was the easiest way to get them out of there, and then padlock the door behind them until, you know, next group might come by and shoot it up.
It's a kind of example of nonviolence in action, in a sense. You know, you could have, I suppose, called in embassy guards
shot
people.
Well, no, they were, at that point we were not in a position to call in anyone. We really didn't have any protective. See, and even embassy guards, Marine guards, we did have five of them, but their job is not to protect me as a human being. Their job is to protect a facility, a U.S. embassy building that holds written secrets, you know, written documents. And their job is to protect the documents, or if we have to evacuate, to destroy the documents. It's not to come out and save my life.
Yeah.
That's not their primary thing.
Embassies are buildings, not people. Okay.
Yeah, and so you never have enough. So, you know, firepower. You don't have a major military force with every embassy to actually do the protection of folks. You what you're you're banking on the fact that you as a diplomat are there, and there's a certain civility of diplomatic relations, and that diplomats are accorded safety, and even in countries where you may have opposing policies with the government, but the government is supposed to protect the representatives of all governments that are accredited. And we've kind of seen there's been a downturn in the level of diplomatic protections that are given, especially when you see, like, although the Kenyan or Tanzania government didn't have anything with the blowing up to do with the blowing up of our embassies in those two countries, but diplomats are not accorded at all any sort of favored status. They are targets now in this war of ideas, and particularly when you are representing administrations whose policies are hated throughout the world. The job of a U.S. diplomat is now very, very difficult and very dangerous. Until these wars, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq started, the people that were getting killed from the U.S. government were not the U.S. military. It was diplomats that were the ones going out and mouthing the words that whatever administration is in power. You know, it's not like diplomats make this stuff up. They represent the administration that is elected by the people of the United States. And a lot of times, you as an individual have to hold your nose at what some administration comes up with.
Think about diplomacy is essentially hyper politeness, and I guess there's this element of really going against your own best judgment a whole lot of the time too.
Well, it is, because as a federal employee, you do the bidding of whomever the people of the United States elect as the president and then the administration, and there may be programs and policies that an administration has that you personally think are terrible, horrible, and stupid. But unless you want to resign, then you, as a federal bureaucrat, have to go ahead and implement those. Or you try to, in many cases, people try to move themselves away from policies that they personally just think are so bad.
Get posted to a slightly different office on the other side of the building.
Well, that's right. Or if you're in Washington, request an assignment from one bureau to a different bureau that may be implementing policies that you think are much more sane and in your something that you can do. So it's not too often that diplomats do resign. We had some that resigned over the war in Vietnam. We had some that resigned in the slowness of the Clinton administration to do anything in Bosnia and Kosovo. There have been, you know, here and there, there have been some, but the three of us that resigned over the war in Iraq were, you know, that was a pretty big statement
pretty big
for the State Department and for the federal government, because nobody else in the federal government did anything. Yeah. Now we've got some whistleblowers that are coming forward.
Yeah, people doing things secretly, but not risking their jobs.
Yeah. And a couple of people were fired for statements they made about the incompetence of their own organization in national security. In fact, tomorrow I'll be down in Washington for a conference with whistleblowers. We're going to the Congress. There are 50 of us that are meeting, kind of organized by this FBI translator who was fired by the FBI.
Cybele Edmonds?
Yeah.
I understand that her case is going to be heard behind closed doors.
Well, they attempted earlier this week. They closed the doors of her appeal on the classification of previously unclassified documents, including the Inspector General of the FBI's report on her firing. She had told her supervisors that. Or senior supervisors, that her direct supervisor was changing translations that she had made, that she was being told to slow down on the translations so that there could be a backlog in the number of translations, and therefore they could hire more people to do this. She went to other supervisors to say what's happening in this section is really detrimental to national security, because we've got to get these documents translated. They may have information that was about 9/11 or will protect us from future possible attacks. And what happened? She got fired. Rather than their taking her allegations seriously, they fired her. So she was protesting, and for the last year and a half, she's been protesting in the courts. And the IG of the FBI finally did this long, lengthy, unclassified report saying she was exactly right. And then what did the FBI do? They classified the report after the fact. And she's going in to protest this classification. And then what did the D.C. Court of Appeals do? They closed the hearing on these now first unclassified, now classified documents. They closed the hearing to the press and to the public. So now there's a big brouhaha with all sorts of media groups protesting the court and the public. And there are 50 of us that will be talking tomorrow to two congressional committees about the need for greater protections for whistleblowers.
Yeah, so that's what the press needs, is some focus for attention, because this ought to be a really big issue, but mm-hmm. where are they going to get those little sound bites if there isn't a conference like this? It
yes.
sounds like a great thing to be doing.
Oh, it's going to be very interesting.
I guess we want to get to the issues of torture, mm. and we want to get to more of your adventures in diplomat land, but I guess we have to play a few more public service announcements and other messages, and then we'll be back.
Great, thanks. Okay.
Ever seen a hornet, Shelly?
No, ma'am.
Oh, well, you're five. What are you waiting for? They've built a nest outside your window. See?
No.
You will when you climb 15 feet up this ladder to get rid of them. Take this insecticide and broom and send those stinging meanies packing.
What if I fall? I could get hurt.
Oh, you know about gravity already. You're so smart. Oh, go, 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 go. The hornets are waiting. Scream at them, dear. Hornets hate high-pitched noises. Yeah, try not to swallow too many.
Get away!
Now knock that nest out of the park.
You wouldn't treat your child like an adult, so why put them in adult seatbelts? If they're under 4'9", they need a booster seat.
I can't see! Are they biting me?
Oh, that's so cute. No, honey, hornets don't bite, silly. They sting.
Ow!
For more information, go to boosterseat.gov. This message brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Department of Transportation.
French music at WUML Lowell. Listen to French songs of yesterday and of today. Venez écouter la musique au 91.5 FM. Les chansons en français d'hier et d'aujourd'hui. This show, called Your French Connection, is for all lovers of French music everywhere. And you can call in your requests at 978-934-4969. It's all at 91.5 FM. C'est pour vous la musique en français. Tous les samedis soirs de 18h à 21h, this music is for you. Saturday evenings from 6 to 9, your host at the station, Jeannine Richard. The program, Your French Connection at WUML Lowell. Venez nous écouter.
Did you know that mental health problems affect almost every family in America? So chances are, someone you know and love has a mental health problem. Get the facts about mental health. Call 1-800-789-2647 for a free brochure. That's 1-800-789-2647, because mental health is a part of our lives. This is a public service from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and your friends here at WUML Lowell. And we're here in the studio with Anne Wright, the diplomat who resigned over the start of the Iraq War, and several other important issues. And well, we're talking about various places she has been in the Foreign Service. A lot of these are real hot spots. You've been in some rather tense situations.
Yes.
But then Afghanistan must have been a relatively tense situation, too.
Well, it was. When I was on the first team of State Department people to go into Kabul, Afghanistan, and reopen our embassy that had been closed for 12 years. We considered the embassy to be kind of the target, the bullseye for what we figured were still remaining remnants of Al-Qaeda that were in Kabul. and some of the more militant Taliban that hadn't taken the free flights out with that the Pakistanis had arranged with the United States government to get a lot of the Taliban out of Afghanistan and into Pakistan. It was tense, and it's more tense now, though. Quite honestly, there was a window of opportunity from December until probably February or March where things were pretty settled in the city, although there were a couple of the warlords that had decided that they would start sending some rockets.
December to March of 2001.
Yeah. December of 2001 to March of 2002. The warlords were already beginning to reassert their authority. You know, many of the warlords we had hired to fight our war against al-Qaeda, and to the extent that we had a war against the Taliban, it was the warlords that fought it. General Dostum, a couple of Atta and the Northern Alliance that used to be led by Massoud, we paid them millions and millions of dollars and gave them lots of weaponry to fight. We had very few U.S. military in there, quite honestly. We had special forces guys that helped organize the warlords, and we had CIA paramilitary operators that were in. In fact, the CIA has had a big Air Force in there. I mean, it's just kind of like old Vietnam days of Air America.
Not the U.S. Air Force as such, but a U.S. Air Force.
The U.S. Air Force was high above, and
way
a U.S. Air Force was down below. But the majority of the bulk of the people that really pushed particularly the Taliban around, and then initially with al-Qaeda, were the warlord forces. And indeed, these are the guys that now are well-financed and have new weaponry and who will, in my opinion, be there to cause lots of trouble when the United States and the international community says, we've done enough for Afghanistan. You know, a poor country, 25 years of war that it's had, and yet the focus of the international community never really was on Afghanistan. It was quickly diverted from the events after 9/11, and in my opinion, going after the Taliban, we never really went after them. They were already in Pakistan by the time we got to Afghanistan. The probable response of the Bush administration, this is one thing the Bush administration has surprised, I think, al-Qaeda and a lot of other people on, that there was no immediate retaliation after 9/11, that indeed even just sending cruise missiles into the Taliban training bases in Afghanistan, something that I think they probably anticipated.
A tested response, yes, from previous administrations.
That's right. Well, remarkably, the Bush administration, I guess, didn't waste any cruise missiles there, but the actual confrontations with al-Qaeda have been, I think, pretty few and far between in terms of really a type of military operation that potentially could have gotten a lot of these guys. Although the guys know exactly how to fight in that terrain and how you go in small little groups in torturous mountainous areas so that you protect yourselves. And the U.S. military is finding itself in a very difficult predicament trying to capture any of them. And whenever they reappear from their bases now in Pakistan, they know the routes, they know how to get around, and al-Qaeda is still a threat as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and so in some sense, whether it's a matter of not enough troops in Afghanistan or not enough people of some sort there, Afghanistan is so far on the back burner that we just don't hear about it anymore.
Right, the diversion of resources to Iran or to Iraq, and that was, that really weighed heavily in my decision to resign. I had seen that the United States was not doing right by Afghanistan and then to divert the resources that really should have gone in my opinion, into Afghanistan, just it made no sense to be doing Iraq right now. The other part of this whole thing that really the administration has just steadfastly refused to acknowledge, and the reports that have come out of the 9/11 Commission reports, the investigations of the U.S. Congress, we are still in denial that there may be some rationale of why people hate us and why al-Qaeda may still strike us, that indeed there are outstanding issues from Al-Qaeda's point of view and from other militant groups around the world. And those are policies that they feel are policies that are detrimental to various peoples on Earth and to the Earth itself. I mean, the huge environmental disaster that the United States is causing. And you can't tell me that when our tiny little country, tiny in terms of, what, 270 million people, and we suck up 25% of the oil resources of the world, you know, that's something that they know. We don't acknowledge as we drive our big SUVs down the road that we're sucking up all of this and we're putting out pollutants and that we are major contributors to global warming that's sinking the islands of the Pacific. But those people know it, and they hate our policies. They may not hate us as Americans, although I think they're hating us more and more as individuals now because we are not changing our governmental policies. We had a chance to change the government in November of 2004, and the American people, by not a majority by any means, only by questionable 2 million votes, chose not to change the direction of the policies of the United States. Because we had the chance and we didn't take it, I would say that the probability of us receiving more indications from groups like Al-Qaeda that you haven't changed your ways and we will, again, get your attention. And I certainly hope it's not something like 9/11, but what other ways do they have to get to us, to tell us, to look at what we're doing, that we have unbalanced policies in the Middle East? And now that we've invaded a country that didn't do anything to us for its oil, that we are sucking down oil at great rates, that we are abrogating treaties that have stood the test of time and that have helped the world to the extent that there ever is peace in the world. These treaties do help. But, you know, the Bush administration's decision to, you know, undercut the non-proliferation treaty, to undercut international criminal courts, you know, all of these sorts of things, there's blowback to this. And the blowback, tragically, is for the first time we're seeing attacks on American soil.
We saw that one big attack on American soil. That's 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And have you been following Ward Churchill, the Colorado professor, who basically he has made some intemperate mm-hmm. statements?
Yeah.
He's been you know, a champion of American Indians versus the United States government for a long time. And he clearly brings together the peoples of the world who are victims of the United States and says these people are going to attack us.
Mm-hmm.
These are chickens coming home to roost, as he said. He got into a lot of trouble for the way he said it, and may yet, you know, lose his job, although he's a tenured professor. But it's very difficult to talk about these things in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to understand, you know, mm-hmm. that collectively we're acting on the world very powerfully, and as long as we keep doing it, you know, acting this way,
mm-hmm.
people are going to hate us.
Yeah. I live out in Hawaii now, and at the University of Hawaii invited Ward Churchill to come out and speak. And, of course, there was a little bit of dissension in the community about why would you have a guy like that come out and speak. But, you know, listening to him, he is a very considered, thoughtful person. And while I agree with you, some of the words that he used in an article that he wrote, what was it, 3 years ago, that only now is getting attention, the words and the analogies, I think were a little harsh. But I think from hearing him speak in person and his explanation of all the stuff that's going on, I mean, what he is doing is highlighting to the American people that, just as you were saying, that a lot of groups are around the world that have been affected by detrimental U.S. policies are speaking to us, and we need to be listening to them about what's happening to them. And you look at this whole issue of globalization. You know, let's have an even playing field so everyone can participate in the commercialization of the world. Well, even my foot, I mean, it's even only if we get all of the benefits, and no other country, I mean, everybody has to compete on their own, and when you're little Guatemala with your tiny, comparatively, say, coffee crops against this, that, and the other thing, or you're, you know, the litany of it. I mean, the rest of the world knows and they see that this thing of globalization, where we're trying to get everything for as cheap as we can and then protect our own domestic industries and yell bloody murder when somebody calls our hand, where we've got, where we use support prices as support mechanisms, and yet they are being held accountable and being hauled into court when they support their own national products that will be done in by the huge wealth and economy of the United States. I mean, these are the things that the lives that are affected all over the world by our policies are enormous, and we need to listen to them. And as far as I'm concerned, our government isn't listening to them, and I don't think the people of America, as we continue our extravagant lifestyle and in our no way moderating how we live so that we can protect our environment and our planet. There are other things that are going to happen to us, tragically, I think, to get our attention.
Yeah, and I guess we could go on about this for about 75 hours, but you do have a plane to catch to Washington, and I guess the show is theoretically supposed to end at noon. But we wanted to talk about the issue of Abu Ghraib and torture in general, and you were...
The whole issue of what the United States has done to people that we have picked up for their alleged connection with some sort of whether it's fighting against U.S. forces in Afghanistan or Iraq, and using these tortured terms of enemy combatants so that we don't have to provide them with the protections of the Geneva Convention. The policies of the Bush administration that were fought desperately by the U.S. military itself. And in fact, the four chief lawyers of each of the military services were united to say to the administration, do not undercut these Geneva Conventions. And the administration, led by Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, anything we can do, in their opinion, to get away with using torture or using techniques that will elicit whatever information we need, and of course...
Or say we need.
Say we need, yeah. Well, the bottom line is that we've gotten ourselves into a tremendously horrible legal and ethical and moral predicament. We have tortured people, and we have done things in Abu Ghraib that, when we see the pictures... We see a few pictures. We don't see all the pictures. In fact, we're seeing a very selected view of pictures, which I believe is a purposeful distortion of what went on and a purposeful attempt at diverting the blame from senior civilian and military leaders to junior grade reserve people. If you look right now, the only people that have been court-martialed for anything having to do with Abu Ghraib are low-ranking reservists. Not one active-duty person has been court-martialed.
Regular, basically.
Yeah. The active duty is staying out of it. They haven't been hauled in on this thing yet. But if the U.S. Congress, who has seen many of the photos that they now say, the U.S. public should not see this, these are too disturbing. Well, gosh, if they're more disturbing than what we've seen, and who are in these pictures? Are they the same seven to ten reservists? No.
They didn't have time to do all that.
Yeah, they couldn't have done all of that stuff. I mean, not these reservists, they have to stand accountable for what they did, the terrible things they did against military training. That was wrong. But there are a lot more people that were involved in this thing. Right now, the ACLU has a court case against Donald Rumsfeld, General Sanchez, Brigadier General Karpinski, and Lieutenant Colonel Pappas. They filed that in four district courts. That's the first time that we've had any senior people that will be accountable. Human Rights Watch 2 days ago issued a 97-page report on torture. And they are calling for the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate this, because the military will not investigate upwards. The Congress will not investigate. So Human Rights Watch is saying the administration must appoint a special prosecutor. Well, what are the probabilities of that? I would say they're pretty low. But if you look at historical precedent, when Bill Clinton finally got forced, he was forced into appointing a special prosecutor, old Kenneth Starr. So I would say we, the people of the United States, have to put pressure on our congresspersons to force the administration to appoint a special prosecutor, because we need to get to the bottom of all of this stuff. And these poor little reservists who did bad things, well, they're being hung out to wash and hung out on the line. And there are other people that are that have to be held accountable, just like these guys and gals are being held accountable. So we can't let them get away with this stuff, saying the pictures are just too horrifying to see. Well, I don't want to see them. I mean, it's terrible to have to see them, but I want to make sure all those other people that did nasty things get their day in court.
Yeah, so it's very important that citizens contact their Congress people and get a special prosecutor.
That's right.
Was public pressure that got all the other special prosecutors that have ever been appointed.
Yes, indeed. And you can be guaranteed the Bush administration on its own isn't about to investigate itself, because there is a reason why the administration was arm-twisting countries. In fact, telling them that the United States, I know this because I had to do this to the Mongolian government. If you do not vote against the International Criminal Court, and if you do not cough up troops to go into this war, this coalition of the willing, we, the United States, will cut off your economic and military aid. And indeed, we did that to some countries. The Mongolians finally capitulated, tragically. They capitulated. They voted against the Article 98 Criminal Court. They coughed up 30 Mongolians that some went someplace in Iraq, and I hope they stayed safe, that they kept their heads down. But
because in Iraq, the word Mongol has very negative connotations.
Well,
it was the Mongol invasions that was one of the dark moments in the history of the country, you know, that they keep referring back to.
Absolutely. And in fact, the Mongols themselves, in fact, the president of Mongolia, when he went to visit George Bush, he, in an endearing term to George Bush, apparently said, well, you know, the last time there were ever invaders in Baghdad, it was us, and it looks like you'll be next. Well, that put him in great favor with the Bush administration, and Mongolia is now set to be one of the recipients of this huge Millennium Challenge Account developmental funding.
This is something we haven't heard much about. Now, what is the Millennium Challenge Account?
Well, it's a super fund of economic development funding, $5 billion, 5 years' worth of funding that the Bush administration decided to create. And when this was created, I was mystified. I thought, of all governments, the Bush administration, that really has such insensitivity toward the rest of the world, why would they be, they of all groups, be creating this super fund that really caused quite a stir in the developing world, that here were a chance, rather than $10 million on an annual basis getting for roads and stuff like that, the possibility of maybe $100 million so you could really get a big project done. Now looking back on it, I feel quite certain it was a part of an earlier plan to have large funding elements available for people that would go along with your war in Iraq.
But it might also sort of incidentally do some good.
Yeah, but it was the leverage that you got, and if you talk about Mongolia, the leverage to vote against the International Criminal Court, a court that many people of the Bush administration, I think, would be hauled in front of for an illegal war that they've caused in Iraq. There were reasons why they created that super fund, you know, to get this International Criminal Courts process out of the way for them.
It's scary to think there are people who are strategizing in this way, you know, mm-hmm. thinking, well, what can we do to get a coalition of the willing, and what mm-hmm. can we do to defeat the International Criminal Court? I know we can offer them a bribe, a huge bribe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The U.S. is famous for giving less in international development aid than most small European countries per capita.
Yes. You know. Yeah. Well, and if you look really at what we have ultimately given into Afghanistan, you know, that country that is such a basket case. I mean, compared to Iraq, Iraq is a super, it's like Boston. It had freeways, it had bridges, it had big buildings, It had infrastructure, an infrastructure that worked until we bombed the hell out of it. And now trying to get it back to even what its levels were of water, sewage, electricity than before the war. We still haven't done that. And we've never put
mind
in...
before the first of the first Gulf War.
Yes, yeah. And then for Afghanistan, we have never come through with anything close to what we were promising the Afghans in the beginning. And it's really a tragedy, and it's a I who was in Afghanistan in those early years, I mean, early months that we were there, I am heartsick that we have really bailed out on them, and the administration needs to be taken to task for that.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much wraps up the basic points that we needed to cover, and it's about 4 minutes before noon. I wanted to mention that you've been touring the Northeast, and this is basically the last stop on the tour here in Lowell before you head back to head down to Washington, D.C. The people sponsoring the tour were Swing the Vote, and I wanted to acknowledge them and just let you know how to find out more about the Swing the Vote campaign. It's swingthevote.us on the web. If you go there, you can find out more information about what they did during the last election here in this country and what they're planning for the next election. They are beefing up their legal status so that they can support targeted candidates who are in favor of a peaceful solution to the world's problems and various issues that I'm sure we have, you and I share a concern about, and many of our listeners do too.
Indeed. I mean, we've got a great job, a big job ahead of us. The people of America really have got to make some fast movements on changing the direction of our government, and there's a lot of danger out there that we're causing for the world, so we can't just sit back and let this stuff continue. So I urge all your listeners to, join up with lots of good organizations and make your voices known, and let's get some good changes for America.
There's also, you have a website, and you're a member of the Oahu Democrats, is that?
Well, I spoke for them back in the summer of last year.
Might this be a good place for people to go on the web and find more statements by you, or do you have some recommendations?
Well, if you just Google Anne Wright Diplomat, there are a variety of things.
Anne Wright Diplomat. Okay, mm-hmm. So go to Google and try Anne Wright Diplomat. I'll take your word for it. I don't have quite the time to actually do it now. But, yeah, so you're mentioned in a lot of different places, and you're a great speaker, and it's really been wonderful to have you here in this region. I hope you can come back again soon.
Thank you.
So thank you, Anne Wright. And you're listening to Thinking Out Loud.